Good morning. Good afternoon. Please go ahead. This call is now being recorded.
Thank you so much, Francesca. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the PPFAI Working Group call on the 3rd of March 2015. On the call today, we have Val Sherman, Graham Bunton, Steve Metalis, Justin Macy, Holly Reich, Chris Pelling, David Heasley, Sarah Wild, Alex Deacon, Frank Mischlick, Michele Nalon, Kathy Kleiman, Dick Kleening, Griffin Barnett, Volker Greiman, Keith Kupferschmidt, Vicky Schickler, Todd Williams, David Hughes, Terry Stummy, David Cake, Susan Caragucci, and Jim Bykoff. We have a tentative apology from Don Blumenthal. And from staff, we have Mary Wong, Rika Kernings, and myself, Natalie Peregrine. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you ever so much, and over to you, Graham.
Thank you very much, Natalie. The usual, does anyone have any updates to their SOIs before we begin? Going once, going twice, sold. All right. So welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Apologies for missing last week. I was on vacation. It was delightful. I was reading through the transcripts of last week's call, and it looks like everyone got a chance to go through the document that was floated by Steve and I and the product of a number of us working together to try and get something out there for discussion. And I think that was really good. We still have some work to do, and Kathy certainly floated an interesting email, I think that was last night, that's going to be good for discussion today. I thought we would spend the bulk of today continuing on this disclosure draft. We need to talk a little bit near the end of the call about the face-to-face facilitated meeting possible in Buenos Aires, so we'll carve about 10 minutes out for that. And Mary also sent out our updated work plan, and that's worth looking at for everybody. We've got, I think, about 6 meetings to go. We aim to publish a final report between now and Buenos Aires, which isn't a lot of time. Now, we have a lot of work done on a draft final report, but we still have some pretty heavy questions in front of us. So I hope that we're able to move forward and answer some of these questions and get that out there. That'd be great. And so if I can editorialize, maybe set some context before we move on. What it seems to me like, and perhaps this is obvious for everyone, but maybe it's a nice way to start the call, is you know, really what we're trying to do here is figure out how to reconcile. I sort of think there's 3 separate concerns or areas. And, you know, I apologize if I mischaracterize these, but I think I've got it reasonably well. Is, you know, IPC is looking for a consistent, transparent and reliable process for addressing infringement. Proxy and privacy providers are looking for an economical and implementable solution that also protects our registrants, and we have others that are also looking out for privacy and due process. And we need to figure out a way to amalgamate all those concerns and put something forward that we can all live with, hopefully, and answer this question. So this draft was put out as hopefully a starting place for discussion, and it looks like last week we got some of that, and Kathy kicked that off on email, which is great. I will say now that I think we do need to encourage a bit more list participation, if we could. So thank you very much, Kathy, and others who responded to that email. I think there's a bit of responsibility on us chairs to encourage and maybe push back a bit and ask some more questions and help facilitate or moderate on the email list so we can get a bit more discussion going there, because if we only have these 6 sessions left, we need to be a little bit more vibrant on that list and not just reserve all of our conversation for the calls. So going back to the disclosure draft document, there are a number of changes that Steve made that were incorporated, and perhaps as a first step, we can walk through some of those changes, if that was okay with you, Steve, and then we'll, I think, dig into part three, which is where I think most of Kathy's questions came in. So, Steve, if it's okay with you, if I can put you on the spot to walk through the changes that you put into that document. Oh, I see a hand from Justin, so let's maybe do that first. Justin? You might be on mute, Justin. Still can't hear you. All right, so let's go to Steve, and then and Justin, if you can sort that out, we can come back to you.
Okay, thank you, Graham. This is Steve. Yeah, the only changes made here were really the ones that were brought up on the call last week. I think they're all fairly minor. First, on in section 1B, Romanet 3, on the first page, I incorporated a comment from James that the idea of the cost recovery fee was not to be something that would serve as an unreasonable barrier to access to the process, so I just plugged that in there. Thought that was a useful elaboration. The second change is on page 2, actually in all of the templates, I think, at McKaylee's suggestion, we moved up, you know, the domain name that infringes the trademark or the URL where infringement is taking place, we moved that up to the top. Again, we're not dictating, this wouldn't dictate a form necessarily, but I think his point was well taken that the first thing the service provider needs to know is, you know, what domain name are we even talking about here? So that change was made in all three templates. The next change is on page 3 in the template regarding domain name resolves to website where copyright is infringed. At James's correct suggestion, in what had been number 4 and now is number 5 because we've moved URL up to the top, because I moved that to the top, the second half of that paragraph remains. The exact URL where the original content is located, if online content, or where the claim can be verified. That remains in brackets because there are some concerns about that, but basically that splits up, you know, the URL where the infringement is claimed to be taking place and moves that up to the top. In C, which for some reason in the earlier version was marked as A, this is on page 4, and I don't have any explanation for that. Again, I just moved up the exact URL where the allegedly infringing content is located, moved that up to the top. And then I think the last change in here was as a result of Kathy's comment from Kathy that there was it was not clear in 3D if there was no civil action pending, what effect that had, or whether if there was a civil action pending, it could have an effect. So all I did there was put in lack of, but not only for lack of a court order, but also lack of a subpoena or lack of a pending civil action, UDRP or URS proceeding, to make it clear that under 3D, none of those could be the sole basis for refusing to disclose. So it wasn't intended to say that because there's a civil action, we refuse to disclose, that would be an inadmissible reason. So I think hopefully that clarified that on 3D. Obviously, that remains bracketed, and that's a very important provision from our perspective. So I think those were all the changes, and again, all of them were intended to reflect the discussion on our call last week. Thanks, Graham.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. I'm seeing from Michele that I think where we've moved the, if I'm capturing this correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, that where we've moved the exact URL to the top. We need to make sure that it's alleged infringement. Actually, I see your hand up, Michele. Go ahead.
Thanks, Graham. No, just in terms of consistency, I mean, it's also something that Kathy put in her email. Just, you know, if it's URL, content, whatever, the terminology should be allegedly infringing, alleged infringement, et cetera, et cetera. Just for the sake of consistency. Thanks.
Sure. I think that's a reasonable addition, and we can make sure to capture that. Kathy, I see your hand is up.
Hey, Graham. Can you hear me? It's Kathy.
First, I
am glad you were in someplace warm without multiple feet of snow. That sounds really nice. And I just wanted to share that last week was really not so much a discussion as a walkthrough, which I really appreciated, and I think others did as well. With Steve, I guess the draft had come out the day before, which was great, and then Steve really walked us through it, and there were questions, maybe a little discussion, but questions. I think we're really opening up the discussion for the first time this week. So I just wanted to share that I think this is kind of the beginning for those of us who work with organizations and registrants and individuals to kind of jump in and really begin to kind of wrestle with the concepts here. And similar to Michele, as we look at sections 1 and 2, I have the word allegedly scribbled all over. So I think we need to add it in lots and lots of places, especially our titles, like request template, which is section Roman numeral section 2. A would be domain name allegedly infringes a trademark. In other places where I won't, domain name resolves to website where trademark is allegedly being infringed. So I think we have lots and lots of places to put in allegedly, but I thought Steve got one of them, which is great. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. That's a good point. And I don't think too hard to capture or implement, nor do I think there is too much disagreement on that. You're right, Kathy, that last week did be much of a walkthrough, and we are going to be hopefully really getting into the details and discussing more today and wrestling with those concepts. I'm going to go to Justin, and then perhaps I'm going to come back to you, Kathy. So this is your pre-notice that I'm going to put you on the spot a bit around your email, and hopefully we can think about that and use that as a starting point for discussion.
Thank you. But before
we get there, we're coming back to Justin.
Okay, Graham, can you hear me?
We can.
Can you hear me? Excellent. This is Justin for the transcript. My question really is, I think that the IP issues that we're going over here are really important, but I want to make sure that we're not missing, another picture, which is there's a lot of illegal content or actors that are using privacy proxy services that are doing other harmful things like selling illegal drugs or arms or human trafficking. Are we going to be addressing any of those, or are we really just targeting intellectual property infringement?
Thanks, Justin. I think and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, that we built this template as an example for intellectual property concerns, but the idea was this would give us another place to go for other issues, other related issues, like illegal content. But we still have not really tackled some of that as a working group, and that's still left to do. I see Mary's hand is up. I suspect she's going to respond to that. Mary?
Hi, everybody. Thanks, Graham. This is Mary for the transcript, and in fact, I am. And just to amplify what Graham's just said, Justin and everybody, because if you'll recall, back in, I think it was October or thereabouts, the working group did identify that in terms of requests for disclosure, which is what we're talking about here, there are at least several groups or types of requesters, and IP owners are one of those. And as Graham said, ideally we would want to look at least a couple of the other categories that we identified back then as illustrative examples, if nothing else. And the hope is that we can accomplish this in the next couple of weeks. Thanks.
Thanks, Mary. And hopefully that adds a bit more color to my response, Justin. Michele, I see your hand up.
Yeah, thanks, Michele, for the record. Just to Justin's thing there, most of those sound to be like they're infringements of law. I mean, these are matters for law enforcement. So I'm not really sure why they'd be considered here at all. I mean, if law enforcement wants to access whatever, then they can present a request to a company, be that the registrar or the proxy private service provider. So I'm just trying to understand exactly what you're suggesting. I mean, I'm just a little bit confused by that, because I mean, it's not going to be up to either a registrar or a service provider to adjudicate that a particular domain name is being used as part of some larger case. I see Dick's got his hand up. He can probably speak to that more coherently than I can. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. Mary's put in the chat that anti-phishing and consumer protection groups would be other categories that we might be able to extend this template to. I think, congratulate Dick, because as far as I know, this is the first time he'll have spoken on the call, so it's nice for him to join us and participate. Please, go ahead.
Well, I won't get too excited. I think the comment about law enforcement being involved in this process, even though we do have a jurisdictional process that we can request this information, that isn't for every provider that delivers these services. So I don't think we should be excluded for commenting on this process, because we are part of the community as everyone else is, and we have concerns about gaining access to this type of information to prevent criminal activity and to protect the citizens. So, yes, we are fortunate to have another mechanism, but that mechanism isn't foolproof, and it doesn't work in every jurisdiction in the globe. So we need to be involved, and we need to have this part of this process right. Thank you.
Thanks, Dick, and certainly you're absolutely welcome to participate in the process. And you're right, jurisdictional issues are another topic that we've certainly run into a number of times, and I don't think we've resolved yet. So thank you, everyone. I think that was a good start there. I'm going to come back to Kathy now, and as I warned her, put her on the spot to talk a little bit about the email that she sent. And hopefully we can use that discussion to focus on particular pieces of this document and use that to find a way to compromise and move forward. So, Kathy, if you could perhaps walk us through your email or talk a bit about the concepts in general.
Terrific. I'd be happy to, Graham, and thank you. As you noted, most of my comments refer to number three, Roman numeral three, service provider action on request, which is page 5 in the draft, the revised draft that Steve circulated online. What I'm thinking about here is both big picture and little picture. So before we jump into editing the words, let's look at the concepts. And what we seem to have here is a really good first step, but I don't think it's the final step. So here we have a presentation by, in this case, intellectual property owners of what it is that they're concerned about, what it is that they're alleging the infringement on, and that's very legitimate. And what it corresponds to, Steve has been reminding me for a while that some of the thinking was along the lines of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So I went and I pulled it. And what we have here is really what the equivalent of, in the U.S. Copyright Act now, the elements of notification. So you're notifying, you know, you're, the intellectual property owner is kind of swearing out an allegation identifying the trademarked work or the trademark or the copyrighted work that's being infringed and where it is and how to reach them and what they're concerned about. And here, though, instead of having a takedown, we're having a reveal. And I just wanted to point out that in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and here too, there's another step before you get to reveal, and that is does the allegation sufficiently outweigh the privacy interest? And I'm not sure we've gotten to weighing that yet. So even though the allegation of illegality may be completely legitimate, it may be that the privacy rights, regardless of whether the person defends them or not, the privacy rights outweigh. So maybe it's a magazine publishing, you know, they're using the trademark to critique what a trademark owner is doing or something like that. So a lot of my comments kind of run to the due process, the rights of not only the alleger or the requester, but also the responder, the registrant, the customer. So the first thing I say in my comments is, first, you know, where are the sanctions for misrepresentation? Let's say a company knowingly misrepresents the material or activity. How does the registrant get a hold of that material? I'm probably going to use registrant instead of customer, guys, but you know what we're talking about, the customer. How does the registrant get a hold of that material? How do we have, you know, clear damages, costs, fees to somebody misrepresenting? So, and two, how do we raise the bar? How do we together, whoever's running the slides, I would go to number three here so that everybody, I guess we're all in control. I'd go to section three if we could. But whoever, you know, what is, how do we raise the standard for, you know, for this reveal after a very good allegation is put out? And the first question is, you know, what happens with the default, and who evaluates a default? Because there may be very good reasons for the default. The requester may not be able to respond. I mean, the registrant may be not be able to respond. It may have disappeared into spam. They may be scared to respond. There are any number. They may not have the language in the cases we're working on. So in my material, I wrote down a number of, in number two of my material, I wrote down a number of examples where you could very legitimately use logos, copywritten material, and it's clearly defensible on its face. So you use the logo of a gang so that you can identify them. You use the logo or trademark of a large multinational that you're criticizing in a blog or an online publication or an online newspaper. The allegation against somebody is being made by a battered women's shelter, and kind of on its face, you really don't want to disclose the location of a battered women's shelter without a lot of due process. So in the case of a default, but also in the case of where the registrant responds, how do we have a full and fair evaluation of what's going on here, both the intellectual property owner's rights and the registrant's privacy rights and protections? One option I threw out is a third-party review. And, in fact, it's already in Steve Strath that if the intellectual property owner's request isn't honored by the provider, it should go to some ICANN-initiated forum. So as long as we're creating that forum for due process purposes, let's use it. And that could be for default, or it could be for a tough case that the provider doesn't want to decide itself, and move it to some kind of third party, some kind of independent forum that would take on the difficult evaluation. Another thing that I put in, it's small Roman numeral 4 in my notes towards the end, it's the second to last paragraph of mine, is the privacy of the customers and the providers. Obviously, the requester would like to know what it is that the customer, the registrant, is responding. On the other hand, the registrant, we don't want to make this an inadvertent trap. The registrant is going to want to explain to the provider in their normal language, in their normal parlance, and probably without their lawyers, what it is their response is. Well, I know it's a trademark, but I think it's fair use. I think I'm protected. If you say it that way and you pass it on verbatim, it can go straight to court, guys, as an admission against interest. And we don't want small businesses and entrepreneurs and individuals and human rights groups kind of giving legal language when they don't really realize they're doing it. So I think we need to create some kind of tier here where the customer can communicate with their provider. This is their provider. They're going to feel they can talk informally to them. And then some kind of legitimate summary is passed on, but it's a summary that's passed on by the provider. So it doesn't act as an admission against interest or an unintended waiver or some kind of legal language that the registrant was never intending. And I think that's about it. for right now. Those were the key points I found, but I know other people have been reviewing closely, and I'm looking forward to hearing what other people are thinking as well. Graham, thank you for the moment. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kathy. That was a good response for being put on the spot like that. I'll just put that out there. Do we have any? There we go. So, cue for responses to Kathy's concerns. We'll start with you, Todd, please.
Great, thank you. And thank you, Kathy, for that email. I agree that this is very helpful for kind of discussing going forward. And I think maybe the first thing we ought to do to that is try to distinguish between issues of kind of substantive disagreement and issues of perhaps clarification. And I'll go with two on the latter because I think that might be the low-hanging fruit that we could start with. One is on default, and one is on the last point that you were raising about kind of the verbatim passing on of communications. I don't read 3E of the current draft as requiring verbatim passing on of communications, and in fact, I think it's actually written in order to avoid that. It's essentially just saying the reasons, you know, for refusal of disclosure need to be passed on, but there's nothing that, you know, mentions verbatim. And I guess, again, perhaps that's an issue of drafting that we can make clear that would address the point that you just raised. And then on default, I don't read 3B as requiring an automatic disclosure in case of default. And again, maybe this is something we can make clear. You know, the provider under 3B2 can state to the requester, you know, its reasons for refusing to disclose, but I don't read any kind of automatic disclosure, you know, within that. And then, of course, obviously there's a process for reconsideration of the refusal, and then upon reconsideration, going to the third party, et cetera. But, you know, again, perhaps that, is, like I said, is some low-hanging fruit. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd. And that's good to know. We'll see if there's what a cue we've got forming. Delightful. We'll see if there's sort of agreement on that verbatim bit. And a good point that we can do some clarification versus substantive difference. And yeah, let's try and clear out some of that low-hanging fruit first. Let's go to you, Vicki.
Thank you. And then, you know, further to Todd's point, also in Section 3B3, there is the safety valve to deal with the concern if there's good reason for delay. But the safety valve in terms of someone not getting it is already built in. So I think that was put in precisely to provide the flexibility to deal with some of the concerns that Kathy raised, and but not create a huge loophole to get out of the process. In terms of the more substantive comments, I think we need to step back for a second and think about the fact that, you know, this is coming out of WHOIS, and that, you know, WHOIS was intended to be public in the first place. So it is a different scenario than straight up DMCA type disclosures, and we got to keep that in mind. You know, second, with respect to 512H, which Kathy referenced, there are other provisions that deal with that subpoena, which make it more or less to be de facto that it will be disclosed on supporting the subpoena. I thought we tried to deal with the standard here in a way that addresses some of those concerns without going through the third party all the time. Again, there are safety valves that are built into this in case there is abuse, and it provides to the privacy proxy provider the discretion to deal with those safety valves and to deal with abuses. So we tried to build in, again, safety valves for abuse scenarios, but not let, hopefully, the minor cases of abuse swallow the rule and not make this process work for victims that want to get the information to be able to go to the next level. Thank you.
Thanks, Vicki. Let's keep going on with Kieran's next.
Thanks, Graham. I first of all, I want to add my support to Todd and Vicki's comments. I think that I kind of have a lot of nitpicky things to say about what Kathy proposed. I don't disagree with most of it as principles, but instead of doing that, I think I'd rather just make a broad and general comment, which is that with this document, what we're aiming to do is try to create a simple process by which we can deal with the majority of cases in which we need to seek disclosure. And, we need to make sure that it's not excessively time-consuming or cost-burdensome or cost-prohibitive in some circumstances. And I think that when we start requiring, third-party observation on every claim for disclosure, we start getting into the weeds. And rather, I think that we've built in good safeguards for these fringe cases, these outlying cases where, you're using a gang logo for education, or you have, political dissidents that needs to be protected. And I think that we have in here opportunities for service providers to protect those people that require protection and haven't responded to the request that we sent previously, which is also required of us here. So I think we need to try not to apply the outlying and rare cases to everything in this document, but rather concentrate on where those cases, where there are exceptions built in to address those cases, and instead see how this is going to be applied to the majority of cases. So I hope that makes sense. And, feel free to, if it doesn't, to ask me more questions. But I actually think a lot of Kathy's points are addressed within. So I guess that's my main contribution. Thanks.
Thanks, Kieran. I think what I'm hearing, and everyone should feel free, of course, to respond, that there is some concerns that the safeguards or safety valves built into the process as it stands, or as the example has put forward, may not be enough. And there's, I think we need to walk through that a little bit more, is at least what I'm hearing. And from Kieran and others, there are safeguards built in, and it sounds like from them that they think they'll cover the majority of responses or majority of issues that we'll see. Stephanie?
Thanks, Graham, and I would agree with your summary that you just gave back there. I just wanted to clarify something that's come up a couple of times, but most recently from Vicki a minute ago. The notion that the who is was intended to be open, I think we have to nuance that. Some parties have wanted the who is to be open from the get-go. I have just been reading the fact document 3, and even the FSAC has been saying since early days that there has to be a way for individuals to protect their personal information in the who is. So I think that's a sort of a fundamental way of thinking about these issues that needs to be nuanced. The reason I raised my hand was really to clarify, for those of us not engaged in these matters on a daily basis, like the registrars, for instance, I think we worry that some of these processes are going to be automated. And, I think McKaylee has clarified that if you don't put certain things in the subject line, they're not going to be streamed appropriately. So just for my own benefit, perhaps, I would love to know how much of this process is basically going to be read and interpreted by machines, and how much is going to be read and interpreted by humans. And in that respect, I'm very comforted by the notion that somebody will be executing a warrant through the unpronounceable Irish law enforcement agency that McKaylee mentioned. And I think these are important distinctions that those of us who are worried about it are worried that something will just automatically get you to the next stage without a human looking at it and saying, this hasn't been proven. Thanks.
Thank you, Stephanie. If I can put myself in the queue here for a moment just to respond to that automation question. For us, very little of our compliance function, which includes responding to issues with our privacy service, are automated. The capturing of a ticket is automated, and so we have methods for people to submit, but I'm not aware of any process that at the moment does not have a human touch at some point. And which is something to consider when we're looking at this, that, you know, it does not scale particularly easily. And for someone like GoDaddy, who have considerably more customers than we do, it can be quite an issue. And we need to make sure, as we build this, that it is something that we can make sure we're that we can take care of and put through economically and simply and still has that careful human touch. I don't know of any particular way to automate this sort of investigation. I don't think it can be done. Michele may have something to say about that, but before we get to him, it's Holly.
Thank you, Graham. Holly, for the record. I think I'm just picking up on Kathy's point. If you look at its 3C, the one word, compelling reasons against disclosure, I think that's what we have to unpack. Is that a majority of cases or a minority? And reading the chat, I think it's a minority. But if we can understand what we mean by those compelling reasons, because C also envisages that some people may simply say, I'd rather surrender the domain name than have disclosure. So I think it's teasing out compelling reasons and teasing out if, in fact, we want to go or we think we should go down the path of having some third party decide what we mean by compelling reasons, because I actually think that's the really difficult issue we've got to decide. And if it is indeed a fringe case or something that can come close to easy decisions that can be automated. Thank you.
Thank you, Holly. And that's a good point. Maybe we can work through some examples of what might be a compelling reason. Work through some cases to see what fits for people and what doesn't. Maybe that brings us a little closer together. I have Michele and then Steve. Michele?
Thanks, Graham. Michele, for the record. A couple of things. I mean, first off, the statement that WHOIS was intended to be public, I have issues with. WHOIS was never actually designed with anything specific in mind. It kind of evolved over time. I mean, it was originally a way for network operators to connect with each other in order to tell each other about problems or issues they were having between the two networks. It has evolved. There's a whole load of other things in there now. But saying that it was intended to be anything it suggests that a lot more thought went into WHOIS as a concept than ever really happened. And I mean, if you're looking in the ccTLD space, there's a bunch of ccTLDs that don't even have a WHOIS server. A lot of other ccTLDs either rate limit you to death, so you can only do a couple of lookups, or the amount of data that they'll return is negligible. I mean, in some cases, all you get back is the domain is registered or it isn't. I mean, and that's about it. But I digress. Just for the record, the Irish law enforcement is called An Garda Síochána, so you can learn how to pronounce that. So when you come to Dublin later this year, you'll know who you're talking to. They wear blue uniforms and most of them don't carry guns. And we refer to a singular police person is a guard, and as I say, they wear blue. And for the most part, they don't shoot people or anything else because they don't have any guns. I do like Carlton's comment in the chat, fair to the fringe, and surprisingly for some of you, I do actually agree with Kieran to a point, not kind of too strongly, obviously, but that would be completely out of character for me. trying to develop policies that cater to one specific interest or to one specific set of scenarios is not what we should be aiming for. We need to be aiming for something that, as Carlton says, is fair to the fringe, which I think is a nice way of putting it, but deals with the bulk of scenarios. So it's not it's something that we all equally hate or equally love, but probably not something that entirely satisfies a specific interest. It has to be more balanced. Another thing to bear in mind is one around costs. I mean, I'm seeing some talk here about stuff around due process and everything else, but please, for the love of God, bear in mind how little people are actually paying for these services in most cases. In many cases, the Whois privacy proxy service is either bundled with the domain name, so it's not actually being charged as an extra item, or when it is being billed, you're talking about a few dollars, euro, whichever currency you're comfortable with, per annum. It's not something that is going to generate a massive amount of revenue per domain name for a registrar or a service provider. So loading on all sorts of complicated, convoluted processes around a lot of this probably won't help too much, because most of us will end up putting stuff into our terms of service just going, right, well, if we get a complaint about X, then we're going to terminate the service. I'm not saying that all of us are going to do that, but something you need to bear in mind. Thanks.
Thank you. I feel like I started this call with a long piece from Kathy, and we've got there, so we've continued to have long contributions, and maybe we want to think about making sure we're short and punchy. We've got about 6 minutes left or so before we have a discussion around the proposed face-to-face. Something to keep in mind. Steve, please.
Yes, just three points. First, on automation, I think the expectation was that this process would not be totally automated, as contrasted with the relay piece of this, which, as I recall, when we talked about that, we wanted to design a system that was capable of automation. This is different. Second, on the last point that Kathy raised in her posting, without getting too much into the details of it, I think we certainly attempted to do what she is asking for here, which is to leave it up to the customer to decide what goes. If the refusal is based on the customer's reason, let the customer decide what goes forward as an articulation of that reason. They may have other dialogue with their service provider, but they should be able to frame something that is verbatim what goes forward to the requester, just so we know what the reason is. So I think our intent was there, and Kathy, if you have any drafting suggestions that would better accomplish that, I would certainly like to very much like to see them. And finally, I want to agree with Michele on the last point. If you have a system, for example, that calls for bringing in a third party every time somebody makes a request, which I think is what Kathy was proposing, that's a complicated and expensive and time-consuming system. This proposal recognizes there might be some edge cases where that's necessary, where disclosure is denied and then it's denied again, and at that point, if the requester wants to pursue it, then maybe there should be a third-party system. But if you have that for every request, then you've got a lot of the complications and expense that I think Michele was warning against. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. And I think Kathy's got a response. Kathy?
First, great discussion. I really appreciate it. Okay, so I am feeling a lot better about the term, the responses of the customers that will be passed on to the providers. I had read 3A to be a requirement that the customers pass. It says something about that the customer's precise terms basically will be passed on to the requester. I think we can clarify this. This is great now that I know what the intent was. So let's talk about default for a second. And actually, safety valves. I would love if someone either on the call or an email could outline what is viewed as the safety valves, and so that we have a better sense of what you're thinking of as safety valves, so those of us who are kind of thinking about it from the registrant perspective can respond. The safety valve that was pointed out earlier in the conversation in 3B doesn't satisfy my concern, which is what happens if the customer doesn't respond, if the registrant doesn't respond. Again, for all the reasons we talked about in Relay, that the registrant may never get it, that the registrant may be on vacation for the month of August, that in some of the things we're talking about, that the registrant may be too scared to respond, or the registrant may not have the language skills to respond. So one of the situations when I was talking about a third-party review, it was for anything we as a group choose that third-party review for. So do we want it for everything? Probably not. Do we want it for default situations? Maybe. That might be a really good possibility to pass things on to a third party for a quick review, the same kind of third party, again, that we're already setting up for review of intellectual property appeals. To go back to other concerns, sanctions for misrepresentation, how do we set up a process if the registrant wants to get a hold of the requester and say, hey, this was completely, you know, frivolous. It should not have happened, particularly if the reveal takes place and it's found out that it took place under false grounds. I think that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Michele?
Thanks, Graham. Michele for the record. Just very quickly, just responding to Kathy, I understand her concerns and I do appreciate them. I am wary of, you know, the costs associated with it. The thing is, and I do actually like the idea of being able to have some way of drawing a line on the ground and saying, look, you know, all of these requests against this particular domain, or all these requests from this requester, are complete and utter rubbish and should be rejected. There has to be some way of dealing with that kind of thing. I mean, we've seen cases where companies, you know, they pervert the legislation. They use existing legislation, existing policies that have been in such a way just to, you know, to shut people down, which is a concern. But again, I am very, very wary of making it too complicated. I mean, maybe what you're looking for really is some way of triggering something. I don't know. I mean, Kathy wants to ask me a question. I mean, please, Kathy, ask.
Great. So, Michele, let's go to the default situation. Right now, as I read this, a default situation means that the reveal goes through. First, am I misreading it? And second...
Well, the reveal goes through based on what?
Based on looking at 3, A, B, C, D, E, F, there doesn't seem to be any ability to refuse the disclosure if the customer hasn't responded.
Yeah, well, this is the biggest thing there where it's... See, the flip side to that is, Kathy, right, imagine, for example, that somebody has registered KathyKleinmanIsAPedophile.com and has put up a whole load of fascinating content, which, you know, totally untrue about you, and they're putting that behind Who is Privacy Service. Do you really want the registrar or the privacy proxy service to provide, you know, lots of protection to them? Or what if the domain name is something completely random, algorithmically generated, and the only content being distributed by the domain name is malware of some kind? Again, should there be an entire kind of process, really complicated process around that? I mean, I'm not saying that I have an answer, but I'm just concerned that making things a bit too complicated.
Agreed, but the malware, and sorry to preempt the other people in the queue, the malware situation, I think, solves itself under terms of use with the registrar. We all take down, you know, everybody takes down malware. But in this case...
No, they don't, though. That's the problem. That's the problem, though, Kathy. They don't. If they did... If they did, I wouldn't be getting contacts from InfoSec companies asking me to put them in contact with various hosting providers. Unfortunately, they don't.
let's park that one. Let's maybe park that one for a little bit because I've got a couple more people in the queue, and we need to talk about the face-to-face. So can we remember where we are in that discussion and maybe take that to email or hold it for next week?
Yep.
Good. Great. Vicki, if you can hold on a sec, I think we have David who is on the phone and not in Adobe. David? You might still be on mute.
Hello. I'm sorry, Graham. I was on mute.
There we go.
I'm following the discussion, and I understand a lot of the concerns here. My concern is a much higher level concern. And I guess maybe between now and the next call, we need to address this on the reflector. But it seems to me that we had a mission here to try to achieve something short of to address the cases where it's not obvious to the provider what they need to do, as some of the examples that were, we assume that the provider would obviously know what to do, and the opposite end of waiting until they have a court order. And if all we do is introduce some complicated mechanism that's not, you know, maybe economically feasible or whatever, or leave the option to the provider to wait for a court order or whatever, what have we achieved within this group? That's what I keep thinking when we're going off on these tangents. I'm concerned that our primary objective is maybe not being addressed. I just want to put that out there. You know, if other people don't agree with me, then feel free to go on the reflector or contact me offline.
Thanks for the input, David. Vicki?
Graham, I know that you want to talk about the face-to-face, so if you want to do that first, and if there's time, I'll speak. If not, I'll defer to next week.
Thank you, Vicki. Let's maybe cover that very quickly. Mary might have some more context for everyone. But in Singapore, it was proposed that there is another face-to-face meeting in Buenos Aires, as there is funding for that. And it was proposed that our group is, again, probably in the most appropriate spot to take part in that. Some of that hinges on our ability to get a final report out there and begin to receive feedback from that. And we would, I think the idea is use this face-to-face to go over some of the feedback and look at how we would incorporate that, in our initial report, to then produce a final report. And so we need to decide whether that is something that we as a group think is worthwhile doing. And Mary, if you have any other context, I'd love to hear it. If anybody has opinions on whether it would be a good idea or not, we'd also love to hear that. I don't want to suggest that this is a top-down thing and we have to do it. If we don't think it's going to be a worthwhile use of our time, then we should not do it. I believe the pitch is that it would be on the Friday after ACAN has wrapped rather than before as it had been previously. Mary?
Thanks, Graham. Hi, everybody. It's Mary again. And just to follow up on what Graham has introduced, what we have on screen here is the proposed updated work plan, which Graham referenced at the beginning of this call. And hopefully this will make it easier for everyone to see where we are trying to go in terms first of getting the initial report out for public comment. And here we have an objective of mid-April. Following that, of course, there's a 40-day public comment period at minimum. And then we have the Buenos Aires meeting, and we go on from that to try to aim for a final report that can be adopted by the GNSO Council by the Dublin meeting at the latest. So the thinking is that if this work plan is reasonable and acceptable to the working group, then having gone through what the survey respondents said was a very helpful facilitated session in Los Angeles in October, that having a further one in June on the Friday after the Buenos Aires meeting would be equally helpful in facilitating our work. I'll note here two things. One is that in Singapore, the working group that did a facilitated session was the IGO Curative Rights Working Group, and they have also sent in survey responses. And that the second point is, as you may recall, this is the third in the three-meeting series that's the pilot project for the GNSO Council for this financial year. So this project may or may not be continued next year, but here is an opportunity for the working group. And so Marika and I just thought that we would suggest this both to the council and to the working group as something that may be helpful. Thanks, Graham.
Thanks, Mary. Stephanie, is that a response to the face-to-face?
Yes, I just wanted to strongly support the idea of doing it on the Friday after, because before is usually packed with things, and I'm very sorry I missed it the last time. So I'm strongly supportive of Friday. I think only the NOMCOM and some of the ALAC folks are tied up on Friday, but it's much clearer. Thanks.
Thanks, Stephanie. I do note that Kathy's mentioning in the chat that we tend to be sleepwalking after a week of ICANN, which is an important point. I don't see any other hands on that. We're just about – oh, I see Phil Corwin. So, Phil, if you could.
Yeah, thanks. Just quickly, having participated in the first face-to-face of this group in L.A. and then in a face-to-face in Singapore of a working group I'm co-chairing, which was on the Friday after. I mean, I'm not arguing for or against it. I would observe that when we met in Singapore after the week we had, people were pretty exhausted on Friday. And while we were scheduled for a full day, we broke up about three, and everyone was very happy. So I think at that point, particularly for those people involved with council or who observe council, Friday is a seventh straight day of working, and you know, it's not a reason not to meet, but I think we should be realistic about expecting people to put in a full day of work after six 8 to 10 hour days up to that day.
Thanks, Phil. That's a good point. At the end of ICANN, I am certainly beat. It's 11 a.m., so we'll try and wrap this up. Let's try and have a bit of discussion on this particular topic, too, because we need to decide pretty shortly whether we would like to take part in this or not, because the travel deadlines are coming up pretty quick. And we may end up doing a poll on this one. I see Mary's hand again.
Thanks, Graham. And I realize it's on the hour, but what staff will do is go back and check as quickly as we can with our colleagues on logistics and other types of things that may not have much to do with this working group, but as others have noted, there are a lot of meetings that are normally packed into the Friday before, and that may include some of the cross-community working groups or the ICG or a number of the other high-priority efforts for this year. So we'll go back and check, noting the preference of some folks on this call. And, Graham, I noticed your suggestion of a poll, and maybe we can do that as well. But as I emphasized in the chat, we do need to confirm this soon because of travel plans, including those being supported by ICANN.
Great. Thanks, Mary. Maybe we do look at putting out a doodle poll, something lightweight and easy. Let's end it there. Thank you very much, everyone. That was good conversation today. Let's keep at it over email, and we'll talk again next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Graham. Thank you.
Thank you, Francesca, and I'll stop the recording.